Our speaker tonight is one of our board members, Sandy Cherry. Sandy is a professor at BYU, or teaches at BYU, been affiliated with our organization, like she said, for 16 years. And she's really been an asset, and I think you'll find that her presentation tonight will be a lot of fun as well as very informative. So I'd like to go ahead and turn the time over to Sandy.
My cousin had mailed this book to me. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it, but if you're not, I highly recommend you go out and get it. Dr. John Lerma has written, just another one has just come out. He told me he was going to be able to come, and then something came up, and he said, I'll get back to you, and he didn't get back to me, and I began to panic. And the closer it got to the time, I really was very concerned. He finally did email me and apologized all over the place because he had said he could come, and then he had to back out. So I emailed him and said, you know, I'm going to do a book review on first book, but I'd like to be able to share with my audience the name of your other books. He said he would be more than glad, and then he said, I really would like to come and speak to your group in the summer. So I'm going to book him for July. I'm just going to give you a little excerpt, a little bit. I mean, what I'm going to give you tonight out of his book is absolutely profound. But it's only two or three of the stories, so you will want to get his book. Into the Light. He said, the second book I have written is Learning from the Light. The book is a continuation of poignant stories of terminally ill patients, days to weeks before dying, and the visions and loving and hope-filled messages they receive from spiritual beings and transitioned loved ones. This second book delves deeper into the patient's pre-death experience and near-death experience, and my latest research involving the newest imaging studies like functional MRIs. And this is really interesting. He is now looking deeper into some areas that he has found fascinating. And Dr. Lerma was the director of one of the biggest hospice clinics in the United States. And this clinic is in Houston, Texas. He no longer is with them. You don't write memoirs while you're still with the company because they own you. So he's, which is so wise, and they also tell you what to write. Anyway, his third book will be about his interest in MRIs, blood work, and this is what he said that was really amazing. He said, digital pictures have been taken of patients that reveal blankets of extremely bright white light enveloping several patients' chest, wall, cavity, and lower extremities seconds after dying. If nothing else, that in itself should intrigue you about what this man is doing. Dr. Lerma is a Native American. He doesn't, at the beginning of the book, express a great, strong belief in Christianity. But you will notice that he does as I tell you his stories. But he is so respectful of all backgrounds, whether they are from a religious background or non-religious. But I was very touched by his book. As a researcher, our board will attest to this, I was adamant over the years that we stick so closely to the near-death experience. So for me to delve into pre-death experience publicly before you is really unusual. Tonight what I will do is I'm going to cover some of the stories from Dr. Lerma's book, and then I would like to share with you my experiences with people prior to their deaths. As I went back in my past, and I was amazed at how many times I have had the honor and privilege to be with people as they've died. And then I will close with the story of my experience with my mom. First of all, I want to tell you, Dr. Lerma starts out by telling about a young boy. What has happened is he's directing the hospice center in Houston, and he gets word that there's going to be a patient, a 9-year-old boy, who has an extremely deadly tumor. This 9-year-old boy just impressed him, and that experience was what opened him up to learning more and more and to listening. He was so willing to listen and not judge. The experiences these people were having as they approached death were real. And as he did that, it changed his life forever. That'll be the nice part about hearing from Dr. Lerma himself. He had heard, it was a hot July day, and he had heard that this boy was coming. And he was excited about meeting him. He said, my pace suddenly slowed as I was now surrounded by gentleness, kindness, and perfect love. I had always sensed this love and peace radiate from the hospice facility, but never to this degree. I was about to meet wisdom and knowledge in the form of a blind 9-year-old boy with terminal cancer. Matthew was not assigned to me. His usual doctor was unavailable to attend him, so he, Dr. Lerma, was given this job. I heard that this was a very special 9-year-old boy who had requested a transfer from home hospice to our inpatient unit. Walking toward his room, I skimmed through hundreds of medical and surgical reports, as well as the invasive and aggressive treatments Matthew had received over the last 2 years. I was in awe of how anyone, let alone this young, vibrant boy, could still be alive. I took a deep breath as I entered his room and immediately felt a wave of compassion as I took stock of the ravages of his illness. Immediately I sensed there was something else present that drew my attention more strongly, something not visible but palpable, a feeling, an energy, wisdom, courage. It was something familiar, but I didn't quite recognize it. I stopped for a moment trying to identify the feeling. But Matthew heard or felt me enter the room, so I shook it off. Dr. Lerma was shocked at that point because in the room was the family. And so jokingly, Dr. Lerma turned to this boy Matthew's sister and said, "Now, you must be Matthew." And here blind Matthew is in the bed and says, "Silly, it's me, I'm Matthew." And he was amazed at the boy's intuitive ability to know, just sense when people were present and to know them. It was just uncanny what this boy seemed to understand and know. He said that the boy radiated with joy and had a charismatic way about him. He asked the boy, "Why did you want to come here?" And the boy said, "I know I am going to die because he seems so vibrant and alive." It seemed to Dr. Lerma, I questioned whether it was time for this boy to be in hospice. And so the boy said, "I am here because I am ready to die, but the angels have told me I'm here for my mother and my sisters. They have to learn, once again, to learn, love God." And Dr. Lerma said, "Well, what do you mean?" Well, he found out that what had happened was this boy's mom, who the boy just adored, and the mother adored the boy, very close-knit family. But when the boy was quite young, their father had abandoned him. And the mother, in trying to raise these three children, had become very angry and felt that God had taken everything from her. And then, when she discovered her son had this horrible, horrible disease and was going to die, she felt very angry and had lost all of her faith in God and felt that there couldn't be a good God that could create or allow such a horrible thing. And so Matthew explains to Dr. Lerma, he explains in great detail that I know that I am here for my tumor and my disease is here for me, and it is to bring my mother and my sisters back to God. And so Dr. Lerma asked him, and he says, "Well, how do you know this?" He's talking to a 9-year-old. How old is your boy?
9.
Oh, my goodness. And what is his name?
Aiden.
Aiden, how are you?
Good.
Oh, so see, 9 years old, that's pretty young, huh? That's awesome. I'm glad to have you here, Aiden. Well, at 9 years old, this little boy, he thought to himself, he's so wise beyond his age, kind of precocious, and he said to him, "How is it that you know me?" And the little boy said, "Because the angel have told me." He said, "The angels have told me that I'm here to teach you, Dr. Lerma, and I'm supposed to tell you all of these things." And so then the boy explained, because Dr. Lerma asked him, how do you deal with the pain? And he said, "When the pain gets bad, I go with the angels to ride with the dolphins." And he said it was amazing, as the boy would describe, these wonderful afternoons that he would spend. And he said they usually would come on Friday, so that right after his treatments, they would come on Friday, and that's when he would go, and he would be with the angels, awed by such incredible light from a child. "The angels just gave me permission to talk to you. I have lived this long because I asked my angels for extra time to allow my mother and sisters to accept my illness and death, and especially to accept God." He goes on to say, he said, Dr. Lerma, and he explains about what happened to his mother. Dr. Lerma said to the boy, "But Matthew, don't you want to be healed?" "In the beginning, yes. But now I know that if I'm healed, my mom will not find God, and that is not good. I want to always have my mommy. So I'm going to die to help my mommy find God. This way, I will have her forever. Do you understand, Dr. Lerma?" "Oh, Matthew, of course I do. I don't know what to say. I wish you could be healed and your mom find God too. Why can't angels and God make that happen?" Matthew replied, Dr. Lerma, if you could see the other side, you wouldn't be asking me that question. You will see. It is all going to be perfect. I don't trust that. I was completely mesmerized by Matthew's astonishing revelations. He goes on to tell how he so often talked to him, and Matthew explained to him how these angels taught him, and he was to teach Dr. Lerma about telling others about the most important thing of all, which is to love. And it was an amazing thing that Dr. Lerma, here, this experienced medical physician, was open to listening to this 9-year-old child teach him about love. The boy and Dr. Lerma became very close. One day, Dr. Lerma came into the room and he said, are there any angels with us today, Matthew? Dr. Lerma, I think, really wanted to see one himself. He said, oh, yes, they're here. I looked down all around, but I couldn't see anything, so I just kept talking. How many angels do you see? Three, said the boy. What color are they? They are bright gold. How tall are they? They are a little taller than my favorite basketball player, David Robinson. Do they come to you when you are sleeping or when you're awake? Both ways. They come in my dreams, and we all go swimming with the dolphins and seals and penguins. It's a lot of fun. When I am awake, they teach me things about the earth and people. And then he goes on to tell Dr. Lerma that the earth is sad, that the people need to learn to love and to treat all things, including the earth, with respect and goodness and kindness. Amazing. Out of a boy. This was a story that Dr. Lerma learned from the teacher who had taught little Matthew just before Matthew had to be hospitalized. And Mrs. Smith is the teacher, and this is the story she recounts from this boy who is so unbelievable. She said, Matthew begged to go to school for a show and tell day, and although he was not in great shape to do it, the school wanted to help make him feel good in any way they could. All the kids showed up with that special something that would distinguish them from each other. Lovely Susan brought her goldfish, Jeff his fire truck, and Xavier brought his loving mommy. In the end, it appeared that toys, animals, and parents were the exhibits of choice. That was the case until Matthew was wheeled in the front of the classroom. Matthew said he wanted to show his tumor and talk about the golden one. I was a little disconcerted, this is the teacher speaking, because of Matthew's illness and was very protective of him, but he insisted that it was something he had to do. He said that he wanted to help the kids understand that just because somebody looks different or is sick, that they shouldn't be afraid or shut them out. He said, they're just kids. I couldn't say no to him. To my surprise, he quickly had the kids laughing and asking questions about being sick and if the tumor hurt and what it was like to be in the hospital. He mesmerized the whole room with his straightforward answers, punctuated by laughter and silly stories about the people at the hospital. Then he told them that when he feels really bad, that he goes to dreamland, to a beautiful ocean and swims with the dolphins, holding onto their fins and riding on their backs while they jump out of the water. He told them if they ever get sick, not to be afraid, because God would send special angels to help them. He continued and said that angels are always with you and want to help you. All you have to do is believe and ask. It was a defining moment for everyone in that room. Ever since then, I have to visit whenever I can. The amount of love and peace I get during my visits with Matthew are awe-inspiring. Incredible. Goes on, and as it does, Matthew continues to speak of his mother and his sisters, and they're often there with Dr. Lerma. And then one final day, Matthew is at a point where he begins to see and know that his mother's heart is beginning to change and that she is beginning to know that there is a God through his love and through his exhibiting such kindness and acceptance of this incredible thing that he is going through. It comes to a point where they're all in the room together and Matthew's mother, and they're with his mother and sisters, and they're kind of playing. And there's a karaoke machine in the room. And Matthew's mother picks up the karaoke machine and she starts to pray to God. His mother prayed aloud in the karaoke machine, saying, God, I'm ready to give him back to you now. I don't want him to suffer anymore. I love Jesus. I want to thank you for letting us feel the love for my son for as long as we did. But please don't make him suffer anymore. After her prayer, Matthew, with a look of exhilaration, turned towards me and said, it's done. What's done? I asked. My wish is granted. My family opened their hearts to Jesus. Matthew then gifted me with his final words, "I'll see you later, Dr. Hunter." The little boy nodded his head as if he was sharing a special secret that only I would understand. I knew he meant that he would be by my side upon my death. Powerful. Do children make these things up?
Oh, I don't believe so.
Incredible. Incredible. That is the first story in his book. So you can imagine he has other things that are greater to offer you. Now, I'm not selling books. I'm not making money off this. I'm just telling you the inspiration from these stories is just so powerful. Now, this next one is called The Smile. And this is about a child again. And this is from about a two-year-old who resembled a little rag doll. He was unable to move or open his eyes. He could not cry or swallow or even smile. When Jacob lost his smile, his parents knew his soul was gone. He had such a beautiful smile, and then overnight, the disease invaded his facial nerves, leaving his facial and respiratory muscles paralyzed. He developed normally until he was 1 year old, and then he exhibited signs of a muscle wasting and then began to regress and degenerate. His illness reduced his muscles to jelly, leaving him in a flaccid state, unable to express even his pain. It was heart-wrenching and heartwarming to watch this family try to make its little boy's last days peaceful and filled with love. His mother would rock him and sing to him. His older brother, Michael, who was only 4 years old, this is the powerful thing, how this incredible moment in our lives goes beyond just ourselves, and how it reached out beyond this child who couldn't speak, couldn't express, but touches the lives of his family and others. His older brother, Michael, was only 4 years old and full of energy and life, and did not seem to understand why Jacob slept all the time and couldn't play with him. He sat for hours on the bed next to Jacob, reading him books. They were mostly picture books, but Michael told excellent stories about the pictures, and he never tired of talking to Jacob. After spending more than 4 months at the hospital on life support, that's when Jacob's parents could no longer watch him, and that's when they brought him to the hospice center. Jacob's mother asked me if I believed in heaven. I replied, "Why, yes, I do." She went on to say, "I was contemplating about our traditional Jewish belief that souls go to a place called Sheol, a dwelling place of all deceased where they wait for their Messiah to resurrect them. There are many Jews nowadays who have varying beliefs, including Messianic Jews, who hold the Christian heavenly principle. I love my religion, but I want him to go to heaven so he can run and play and do those things he was not able to do here on earth. He deserves that. He's just an innocent little baby. I spoke with the rabbi, and he said that I can pray for that. What do you think, Dr. Lerma?" And Dr. Lerma also agreed and said, "I believe in prayer, and that it's so very powerful." Within minutes of finishing this tale, Jacob opened his eyes, smiled really big, and raised his arms as if he was reaching for someone above him. I was stunned. It was impossible for him to rally that kind of muscle strength. He smiled, his arms extended, and then he died. His mother was sitting on the bed, and she was too shocked to cry or say anything at all. Michael had been playing on the floor, and when Jacob died, he stood up and walked towards the bed next to his mother. As he was about to sit next to his mother, he abruptly stopped and went around and sat on the other side. "Curious," Sarah, his sister, asked him why he moved to the other side of the bed. Michael quickly replied, "There's an angel sitting next to you, so I couldn't sit there. Don't you see him, Mom?" She looked flabbergasted, but she felt comforted by her son. Michael suddenly touched his brother's body and ran out the door crying. Before we could go to him, he turned around and calmly walked back with tears still on his face. He walked up to his little brother and lifted his arm. His mom asked what he was doing. He said, "They're right." "Who's right, sweetie?" "The angels. They're in the hall with Jacob, and they told me his body is just a shell. They told me to come and see for myself. They're right." He lifted Jacob's arm again and let it drop. "It's just a shell. Jacob is with the angels." Michael said Jacob was smiling and laughing and doing some somersaults in the hallway. Sarah and Michael looked at me with both questions and hope in their eyes. I'm a child. Sarah, going to share one more story from Dr. Murray's book. It's so funny, I read this book a few months back, and when I read it, this story touched me so profoundly, because I think, like all of us, we at times have looked at horrible crises and events in our time, and we can't understand it. And one of them, of course, is the Holocaust. And this is about a man who was a part of the SS Nazis and what happened to him. And it is so incredibly beautiful. It addresses the whole issue of, can we be forgiven? Are we forgiven? And also, I think that sometimes we wonder, how is it that persons can be so horrible all their lives, and then at the end, somehow, they see the light, shall we say. So let me tell you about this story. William came from Argentina for his lung for treatment for his lung cancer at the world-renowned MD Anderson in Houston. After 3 months of intensive treatment, he was transferred to the hospice center where Dr. Mona is. Shortly after his admission, his level of cognitive function rapidly declined, leaving him almost comatose and intermittently delirious. This is the part that's amazing. During this time, he frequently flailed around on the bed and would often speak in German, screaming for help. So, here he is flailing around, and he would say, "Heil Hitler," other German army salutations. I wiped the sweat from his brow and touched his arm soothingly. I found it strange that he spoke German, but his wife confirmed that they were both born and raised in Germany and fled to Argentina shortly after the beginning of World War II. When we treated the cause of delirium, which was dehydration, his level of consciousness improved. He began to communicate and ask a multitude of questions. Where am I? Am I dead? Was I talking about the war? I told him that he was alive and in hospice, and he did speak of the war. And he said, "Well, what did I talk about? Did I talk about Hitler? Did I speak of that time? Was my family present?" He was very anxious and obviously concerned. I told him, "Yes, in fact, you did speak. You were speaking in German, and you did say Heil Hitler, but no, your family was not present at all when you spoke of these things." He instantly started crying and begged me not to tell anyone that I had heard what I heard him say, especially his family. Weeks passed, and during that time, William and Dr. Lerman developed a close relationship. And William began to disclose that he had been an officer in the SS Hitler's army during World War II, and he had directly witnessed and participated in the extermination of his race. He wept as he told me this, and he seemed truly remorseful. He described how he locked Christians and Jews, both young and old, in the showers and turned his back, while other trained officers pumped cyanide gas through the shower. He recalled one night when a beautiful Jewish woman stopped before entering the showers and looked him straight in the eyes. There was no fear in her face, and the look of true compassion burned into his soul. The vision haunted him for the rest of his life. William's command of this concentration camp was short-lived, as he developed a sudden and life-threatening pulmonary disease. And you'll know about this, he poisoned himself with a small amount of cyanide, hoping this would make him ill enough to keep him permanently out of the war and away from the atrocities. Never knowing his plan, Hitler's physicians attributed his grave illness to secondary exposure to the cyanide gas. Instead of being court-martialed for trying to attempt suicide, he was awarded one of the highest awards for bravery and service to his homeland. With his lungs permanently damaged, William never returned to his command. This is the part that's amazing. When I asked him why he joined the SS, he said his work in biochemistry caught the attention of Hitler's elite army, and he was asked to help his country attain freedom from the tyrannical leaders of the world. He respectfully refused, and within hours, several SS soldiers arrested his wife and children. The Nazis had records of all Jews in Germany and discovered that William, who was a full-blooded German, was married to a Jewish woman and his children were part Jewish. They made it clear that all Jews were to be arrested for their acts of tyranny against Hitler's Third Reich, and to be sentenced to death. William explained, I had to save my family. I could not let them die the way millions of others I had heard of were dying. How human beings could put me in a place where I had to choose between saving my family or saving someone else's family. This is how Hitler got people to follow his horrific orders. Everyone was choosing to save their families and close off their hearts and morals. In just hours, we transformed from God-loving family men to cold-hearted killers. All I could think of was how much evil I had to commit to do good. William was so lifeless as he recalled the most horrible event this world had ever witnessed. As the war escalated, so did Hitler's call to improve efficiency in extermination. Here, William finally saw the scope of Hitler's evil plan and realized the mistake he had made and decided to save his family. He said, I made a deal with the devil and I can't take it back. It's too late for me. There is no way I will ever see God. It's too late for me. I now know what God meant when he said that those who save their lives will lose, and those who lose their lives will have everlasting life. He asked me to forgive him, and I told him there was nothing for me to forgive, for he had not hurt me. And then he said, oh, but I have. The angels told me that the whole world was devastated by these horrible events, and that everyone who was born after the Holocaust was affected by what I did. Okay, William, I forgive you. He asked me how long he had been comatose, and I told him it had been 48 hours. He looked shocked and said, that's impossible. I know I was in hell for hundreds of years. I just know it. I assured him he had only been 2 days and asked what he had he experienced during those days. I was in a dark cave, he said, shoulder to shoulder with many other Nazi and Roman soldiers who had been involved in mass killings. I could hear their thoughts and feel their anguish, and it mirrored my own guilt and shame. The emotional pain was deep and raw, and it was unending and seemed eternal. This was hell, Dr. Lerma. How did you finally get out, I asked. You see, Dr. Lerma, there was always a bright light in the distance, and I felt drawn to it, but I was afraid, not knowing what kind of judgment awaited me. I knew it was the light of God and did not feel worthy to even be seeing it. After what seemed to be years of looking into the light, I finally had enough energy to cry out for help. At once, I noticed the formation of an opening in the distant part of the lifeless cavern. From the small opening, I saw light beings walking past the entrance, back and forth, but never uttering a single word or sound. I assumed they were guards that kept all of them from leaving, and I cowered from them, ashamed of who I had been. As I intensely stared at the light beams, I was finally able to obtain eye contact with the female apparition, and astonishingly, there was something familiar about her clear eyes. They were similar to the eyes of that beautiful Jewish woman I escorted into the cyanide showers. I screamed out to her, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. William said, but she stopped and turned her head to look into the cave. Feeling ashamed, he stepped back into the darkness. And as he stepped into the darkness, bright white light placed it. William's soul was now exposed, but the angel's compassion and unconditional love clothed him. He explained, she spoke in a voice that radiated love to me. I forgave you even before you killed me, she said. She started to walk away again, but I called out, wait, don't go. She stopped, turned to face me, and extended her arms toward me. Come with me, and I'll help free you from your guilt. I hesitated, as I felt that I deserved all the guilt. Yet there was something so compelling that I slowly moved towards her loving arms. As I stepped out of the cave, I was bathed in a light that filled me with intense love and joy. The energy was so intense that I started to faint. Falling slowly, I saw her fly towards me and catch me with her soft, feathered wings. Comfortable now, I began to converse about my life, expressing my sorrow for everything I had done. I told her I attempted to make amends, but nothing would take the coldness from my heart. She said, you have a choice. You can accept that you lived the life you chose to live and forgive yourself and move on. Or you can experience the pain you caused in order to be released. William, looking sad, told her it should not be so easy to be forgiven. I told her I caused great suffering, and I need to know that suffering in order to release it. She shook her head sadly and said, so be it. In a split second, William said he entered the minds and bodies of every single Jew and Christian he killed at the Nazi concentration camp. He felt the pain, fear, and death all at the same time. He described being in a concentration camp and being killed in a cyanide shower. And at the same time, he was in his own body, turning his back on the showers and walking away. He was screaming for mercy and help, even as he was ignoring the screams behind him. The people which he had become were crying out to him, asking why, and begging him not to do it. He remembered how he wanted to help them, but he was so afraid for his family that he just couldn't do it. The conflict within was as painful as the death of those he killed. Feeling the pain of thousands of adults and children simultaneously was pure horror. At some point, the woman of light returned and asked William if he was ready to forgive himself. And he said that he was. At that point, all the people he killed surrounded him and forgave him and let him know how happy they were that he had been redeemed. She wrapped him in her arms of light and carried him into the greater light of God. He was bathed in unconditional love. It permeated his entire being, and a message filled his cells with understanding that God had allowed everything that happened in order to teach humanity to stand up against evil. He went on to say, the Holocaust was not created by God, but rather by the raw darkness within man and intensified by man. It is up to man, with the acknowledgement, to not fear or try to control these events, but to learn that with only God within us, we can defeat darkness. We cannot do it by ourselves. William said, that is the biggest lesson. Learn to depend on God, and He will use your free will to make the right decisions and save humanity. Pretty powerful. William finally came to an understanding that his soul lasts forever, and the body is not that important. He really didn't understand that until he was dying. There was no right or wrong in the choices he made. Someone had to die, either his family or the Jewish people. Even if he had allowed his family to die and had given up his own life, the lesson would still have continued. He could not have stopped it. It was bigger than he was. However, now that the lesson has been taught, the whole universe has the opportunity to choose love and compassion and to give aid to those in distress. William realized that they were all one, and that he did to others what he did to others, he also did to himself. After telling me this amazing story over a two-day period, his children arrived from Argentina, and he died peacefully, leaving me to contemplate man's inhumanity to man and to release my own judgments about other people's choices. Any questions before I leave Dr. Irwin's book? Any comments? Quite powerful. It's John Lerma, L-E-R-M-A, Lerma. And MD. Okay? John Lerman. Part of being on the board, and when I was interested in near-death experiences and getting my master's thesis, and worked back in Connecticut with Dr. Ring, I learned a lot about the International Association of Near-Death Studies, and that is an international association, and we are one chapter, the Salt Lake City chapter, okay? Every month I receive this Vital Signs. Every 3 months this comes out. And it was amazing because usually they usually will include in this little newsletter a near-death experience. But this month, They didn't. They included instead a pre-death experience. I thought, what's going on here between Dr. Lerma and the other speaker who canceled? I thought, wow, there's a message here. And somehow I believe that there are those that come here, including myself, that we're here for a purpose and a reason, and there's always someone here that needs to hear something that's being shared. And sometimes we don't know it for a year or 10 years, but all of a sudden it hits us, doesn't it? And we've had this happen to us over the years that we have been coming to these meetings. And so I thought I would share this story and then share my own experiences. This was written by Mary Ann McCarthy. She submitted this, her experience, and it was published. And it happened quite some time ago. It was in the late 70s that it occurred. So I'm going to read a little bit, and then I'm going to tell you. But again, like I did with him, I hope I wasn't boring by reading. Mary Ann said, on our first date in early 1978, David told me of a Caribbean adventure he had planned for January, February 1979. He and five others would travel to moorings in Tortola, it's in the British Virgin Islands, and charter a yacht for a two-week exploration of the neighboring islands. That sounds exciting. And she said that what happened was David had captained the yacht, and so they were willing, in other words, they were willing to rent the yacht to him and let him captain it. And then he invited some other friends who would then be his crew, who were also experienced in yachting. So in the fall of 1978, David asked me if I would be willing to go on this cruise with him. By that time, we were discussing marriage, and I accepted the invitation without hesitation. This is the interesting part. A week before our departure, I began having problems sleeping. I had no ready explanation for it. She goes on to say that she really had never had any problems sleeping at all. And so she was really quite astounded by this. And she said, David said he was having trouble sleeping as well. Our sleeping difficulties began on the Sunday night before our departure. So David said, well, could it be that we're both worried about, you know, something happening on this yachting trip? And he asked her, because she was having the most difficulty, he asked her, well, what's the worst thing that you think could happen? And she said, well, I guess, I don't know, I think I'm worried about maybe being lost. And they joked about it and talked. But she didn't seemed to feel that anything rang true, that nothing really addressed her fear or apprehension, and she still couldn't sleep. So she said, the first Monday night, just before the trip, she said, that night I began to pray out loud while lying awake, for some reason repeating the Lord's Prayer. She was Catholic, and she felt very strongly, had a very strong religious belief and belief in God. And she said, for some reason, as she was saying this prayer, she would say it over and over, but after a couple hours of struggling, she would begin praying and then relax and she would go to sleep. That was her saving grace. She said, the Lord's Prayer worked for some reason. At some point in my anguished sleeplessness, I would think of that prayer and say a veritable litany of our fathers. Each time I finished the prayer, I would repeat one phrase over and over aloud. Thy will be done. Thy will be done, thy will be done. She had no reason to know why, but she said, once she started repeating that phrase, she would fall asleep. So she finally got to the point that she'd go to bed, and instead of going through all of that, trying to get to sleep, she would just go right to thy will be done, thy will be done, she'd go to sleep. And she said it worked. It was very, and I can't sleep? Try it. Might work for all of us. I thought that was really amazing, but she didn't tell him about this bizarre routine. One of the things that she didn't want him to know about was that when it began, she would find herself sobbing. She would just be in such anguish until she learned about saying the prayer, that it was just unbelievable. Just she couldn't stop it. And she couldn't understand. Now this is an amazing thing, because I teach psychology. Psychologists are supposed to know, supposedly, some things. She said she is a psychologist, so she's beginning to think she's losing her mind. She really is questioning herself. She goes on to say that she didn't dare tell David about the entire episode with the prayer. She said, anytime the topic of God or any concept of a higher power came up, David would respond with strong negative statements. She goes on to say, listen, after David died, his dear friend Marty told me that David had had something like a near-death experience when he was hospitalized a couple of years before. He had developed an embolism after surgery and had been clinically dead for a couple of minutes. When he was revived, he told Marty there had been a light, and there was definitely something there. Then he clammed up on the topic with Marty, refusing to discuss it again. He had never told her, Mary, about it at all. She never learned this until after David's death. On Tuesday, and this is just before their meeting, she says, on Tuesday, after I told David that I was in turmoil for some reason, feeling shaky, she said that David tried to help, working with the little that I had told him about my sleep difficulties. Sitting next to me, his arm around my shoulder, his leg warming mine, David asked, well, what's the worst thing that can happen? And they went on to talk about it. She went on to say that the agitation still developed as they got closer and closer to the day that happened. And then it was the Wednesday night before they were going to leave. She said, I began the prayer ritual as soon as I got in bed, so I wouldn't have to go through all that. And sleep came quickly. She said she woke up on Thursday morning, almost 3 days before David died of his first massive heart attack. I was still lying in bed in the twilight stage of consciousness, half between sleep and wake when I had the following experience. Now this is profound. At the time, I guess it was part a vivid dream, part waking fantasy. Whatever the experience was, it was real enough to have a profound effect on my emotional state. Here's what she experienced. David and I both died in some kind of accident. We suddenly found ourselves outside of our body. We were above our bodies, hovering in the air. David was confused and disoriented. He looked around in dismay. Because of his doubts about his afterlife, he didn't know what was happening. I took his hand and began to explain that we had both died, that we were out of our bodies, and that we had to go on. I took his right hand and my left hand, and we started off. I had the sense that he did not yet understand what I was talking about, but that he did trust me. Throughout the dream, David preceded me, and yet I was clearly the guide. He was silent throughout. I did all the talking, nonstop. I was thinking this would be me taking my lesson, because I kept nonstop. Anyway, describing over and over what had happened, and where we were, and where we were going. David walked a step ahead of me, reaching his right hand back to clasp my left hand. We proceeded that way through a place, I don't recall it now, and then into a large tunnel. I kept up the running commentary, telling him what was happening and what we were supposed to do. I said things like, we'll probably come to a tunnel of some sort. Okay, here's the tunnel. We're supposed to go through it now. There will be a light, and that's where we're going. I talked constantly to him, but he never said a word nor let go of my hand. Or he looked back at me once in a while as we walked through the tunnel. The tunnel was large, maybe 40 feet in diameter. It did not seem long, though. After only a brief walk, we reached the end. There we stood, pausing for a moment. In front of us was a door, a beautiful carved wooden double door, like the gigantic doors of a medieval cathedral chapel in Europe. The door soared above our heads. I couldn't make out much detail of the wall around the door, though. We could see that there was a powerful light source behind the door. The light was so strong that it streamed through some of the cracks in the wood, around the edges of the door frame, and through the slight opening in the middle. I had no emotional feelings from the light. I knew the reason. It was not my time yet to be with the light. David did not let go of my hand as he turned to look at me with a questioning expression. With my right arm extended, I pointed to the door. I nodded. That was where he was supposed to go. His expression changed then to one of farewell. He understood now. We were both very happy, happier than we had ever been before. We squeezed each other's hands and simply grinned at each other. I was silent. There was no need for any more words. David still did not speak. He just grinned and squeezed my hand in farewell. He was happier than I'd ever seen him. Then he released my hand, turned away from me, and started walking toward the door. I watched his back as David took the first few confident steps toward the door streaming through the white light. I knew he would be all right. I have to go back and be revived, I thought, in a matter-of-fact way. It isn't my time yet. And I woke up suddenly, completely alert, awake, still feeling the dream's happiness and baffled. What kind of dream was that? Why should I feel so happy about that? David dead? What could be the latent content, that psychology talk, of that dream or twilight sleep stage fantasy that I should now feel so happy and content? I let it go for the time being and got my workday started. I thought no more. more about the dream consciously until David died about 90 hours later. He goes on to tell about they leave for the trip, they get on the yacht, and it's the first night in the yacht. Everything's gone well. They have their guests with them. So they're laying there in bed, and she said, all of a sudden, she noticed that the pillow had been moved from her. She couldn't figure out what was going on. So she said, what's wrong? He was sipping very slowly a drink of water, and there was no expression on David's face. All of a sudden, she was fully awake, and she sat up in the bed, and she threw off the sheet. What is it? I tried to keep my voice calm. She said, what is it? But I could feel my heart beating in my throat, not knowing why. David was calm. I have some discomfort in my left arm and across my chest. He said, oh, he touched that. He gave no sign of pain, however, except for the blank expression on his face. Help, I thought. Get help. I rose to my knees and backed off the bed, not wanting to take my eyes from his, and moved as fast as I could backward. She then said, I'm going to go get Stu. And Stu was in the cabin right next door. And Stu was a psychiatrist. And if you know, psychiatrists are also MDs. And she thought Stu would be able to help. She ran and got Stu, and when she got back, by that time David was in a state where he was not moving. His eyes were totally blank. He was wide awake, but his eyes didn't follow any movement. And Stu went over, worked with David for a few minutes, and he said, David is dead. And she said she knew David was still there. She said, my mind was raced. Oh, she comes back into the doorway of the room, and she sees him, and she says, Stu, the doctor, had given him something for the pain. He looked peaceful now. I'll kiss him awake. I'll pull his arms down from that awful clenching. He'll wake up, she thought. He'll wake up soon. Denial. I heard my mind speak the word. Not a sentence, just that word. My hands dropped down. That would not do. I was needed. David was dead. And he was still in the room. Both things I knew with an absolute certainty. I could feel him right there as if he was standing by Stu, watching us both and looking down at his own body lying there in that anonymous cement block wall room. I had a strong sense that he was confused, disoriented. His death had been so sudden. How much the worse now, being suddenly there. In my mind's eye, I saw him floating upward a little now, over the bed, panicking. Maybe he was thinking this was a nightmare. He was in denial. He needed me now. I could help him wake up to reality. If I could hold myself together just for a little while, I lay down on the bed next to him and reach out to hold him in my arms. My head resting on his shoulder, my forehead pressed against his chest. At that moment, I remembered the dream of Thursday morning, the dream vision. Whatever it was a lesson, I realized, giving me clear instructions about how to help David now. I needed to help him wake up and die. All right, I thought. I understood what I was supposed to do. I buried my face in the crook of David's neck and held him close. His body was still warm. With my eyes shut, I spoke to him silently. I thought to him all the words, the reassurances and guidances I had given him in the dream 3 days before. David could hear every word. There was no question in my mind about that. And no doubt about it, since no more than I would doubt the fact that the sun would come up each morning. I see that. And I saw David in my mind's eye, listening, slowly, slowly calming as I took his right hand in my left hand. Over and over again, I told David not to be afraid, to look around for a tunnel, and to go through the tunnel toward the light. I visualized we two going through every moment of that Thursday morning lesson in my dream. David silent and me doing all the talking, holding hands with David walking ahead of me, and yet I was the guide. I told David that he would be fine and that he need not worry about anyone here. I promised him that I would take care of his mother and his aunt, that I would take care of any concerns he might have. He should not worry about anything here, I repeated, not even Cokie, his beloved cat. I did ask him to return to guide his mother and his aunt and me when we died. After a while of saying all that over and over, I felt a sense of peace. Still, I did not open my eyes and let go of him until his body suddenly became cool. At this point, I sat up in the bed. I remember saying out loud, he's not here anymore. I looked up to a ceiling corner to the left, as if I could see him. I could not, though I knew that was the direction he had taken. At some point, I was sitting by the side of the bed, holding his arm. I covered him with a sheet and closed his eyes. Stu had done that, but it needed to be done again. I felt a strange mixture of emotions. Grief, of course. And grief so sharp I was in physical shock, though I didn't yet know that. But I also felt an intense gratitude of being allowed to help David die. So, pretty powerful. When I read this story, I was brought to the remembrance of something that occurred in my life. It's a quarter after eight, perfect timing. In 2006, 4 years ago, my mother was diagnosed with lung cancer after having had a heart attack. And she was 85 years old, and she chose to not get any treatment. It was a really difficult time for both of us. I went to San Jose to be with her, and I stayed with her for almost 6 weeks until I realized I could not stay there any longer in her one-bedroom apartment, sleeping on the floor in the living room. So I said, Mother, you've got to come home with me. We'll do this together. Now let me tell you, prior to this, as you know, I spent so much time studying near-death experiences. Prior to this time, I had been with my father when he died. And I remember that my dad had said, the day he died, it was that morning, and it was about, maybe about 10:30 in the morning. And he said to my stepmother, is my brother coming? And we knew he was dying, and he had chose to die at home, and we were all there. And she said, yes, he'll be here late this afternoon. And my father said, no, call him now, because I'll be gone before 1 o'clock. Amazing how often this occurs, and just confirms some of the things we just heard. And sure enough, my father died about 12:32 that day, peacefully. He was an amazing man, and he was the first one that taught me that death can be beautiful. He planned his funeral, told my stepmother, okay, I want to be buried in that suit. You know this one over here? I want this one. And she said, okay, I'll have it clean. He said, oh no, I want the sweat from when we danced together last to be in that suit. That's what I want to be buried in. I want my wallet, and in it I want a lock of hair, and I want the statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary and my first ukulele to go in the casket with me. He was so incredible. He told me once, you know, it's really hard to die. He wasn't talking about the pain. He was talking about knowing and getting there, you know, the duration. It was really not quite that simple. But as he came closer and closer, he shared so often so many beautiful things. And his incredible, incredible strength, and never, I know me. I say, look for me, and I feel sorry for myself. He didn't. In fact, all he really ever said was, I feel so bad that I'm putting all of you through such pain, because he knew how we hurt to see him go through such. He was dying congestive heart failure. And so it was a painful time. I learned a lot from that. So when it was time for my mother. Now, my mother and father had been divorced since I was 5 years old. So then after my father's death, my stepmother, by the way, is still alive, and we're very close, but then it was just these 4 years ago that I went through my mother's. So let me tell you about what this story, as well as some of the things Dr. Lerman talks about, how it affected me, or how I was affected by what I had learned. My childhood had been a really hard one. After my mother and father divorced, I had always felt it was my responsibility to take care of my mother. And so I put a lot of effort into doing that. And when you're 5 years old and your mother's, 30, it's kind of backwards. But children, and those of you from divorced families or even have had children, have been divorced and have children, know that children so often take on the responsibility or the guilt. And I was one of those. So as a young child, I really, really struggled. And remember really some terribly painful times with my mom. Well, as my mom got more and more ill, she became more and more angry. The angrier she got, the more I reverted into being the child I was. Fear came back, hurt, pain. Any of you know these kind of feelings? Now what it's like to feel you got over that and then 60 years later have to go through it again? Like, my mom and I had been best friends for the last 10 years, and then all of a sudden she got ill, became my mother, and I became her child. And we were no longer best friends, and it was really strange. If you haven't had that experience, just be alert that it can happen. Anyway, it was a very, very painful and difficult time. But When my mom was diagnosed with lung cancer, I had a very dear friend that gave me a CD, and it was by the Northern Tabernacle Choir. My mom is not LDS. She could be now, I don't know. Who knows? Anyway, you know, for all, we don't know what happens to us when we go there, because I understand there is no names of religions, and that's great. But anyhow, who knows? She, anyway, was she was Catholic, not active. What happened is, as she became angrier, I withdrew. And I remember this friend of mine, because I didn't want compassion. You know when you're angry? Doesn't it bug you that sounds, oh, I know, it'll be better. And you went, wham! You know, if you know, you wouldn't be saying it'll be better. You know, you just don't want it to be that way. Come on, I don't need that. I need you to understand I'm in pain. Anyway, my mother and I were really struggling. And this gal gave me this CD. And it's about home. Anybody know? Home?
Abortion, going home. Going home.
And it's beautiful. And it absolutely has some of the most gorgeous CDs. So now this is so typical of me. I am preparing because I know my mom's dying. So she's given me the CD. I listen to it. It touches my heart. I want to be there for my mother. I want to be able to do everything. I just imagine these wonderful times we're going to have. We're going to have great talks together. We're going to talk about God. And her heart will be tender. And she will, you know, all of these things. Oh, what dreams if we can make them come true as we want them at the time. So, I have the CD. My mom agrees, I'll come and live with you until I die. So she comes and she moves here to Utah. It was extremely difficult, painful for her, difficult times. Just the airplane trip alone with her on oxygen and all the pain she was in was so hard. We came home, we got home. Fixed her room, put all of her things. I tried to make it as much her room and give her as much space as I could. We have a large home, so tried to make it everything she could possibly want. Not even a week later, we took our dog to the vet because she had a little scab. Turned out that she was also dying of cancer at the same time. And it was really a double whammy. If you know me and animals, like some people do, they know that I am. Anyway, hate to call them animals. God's gifts are what they are. They're so close, so it was a very difficult time. During that period of time, my mom and I had ups and downs. Seemed like more downs than ups. So I thought I would play the CD, and she would listen to this angelic, and her heart would be softened, and everything would be beautiful, because the music touched me so deeply. I turned on it, and she would listen, and she would say, "What is that? Turn that off. I can't stand that." And I'm like, oh my gosh, this isn't going to work. You know, and so I really felt so at a loss. I wanted to be like this Mary. I wanted to be the person that could help my mom. So what I learned was each person has to die at their own pace. They have to find their way themselves. And you're fortunate if they invite you in, so that you can be a part of it. During that three months, that was, she moved June, July, and August, and she died August 18th. And during those months, as I said, went up and down, up and down. We talked about death. I mean, sometimes they were touching. Sometimes she let me write in a journal, and she'd tell me what to say. Sometimes they were touching, and then they would be, oh, so frustrating. And it would go back and forth. I invited them. A hospice to come in, and hospice was wonderful. We had a hospice nurse who was a Catholic and brought my mother communion. That was a wonderful experience. So things were going, and the hospice nurse gave my mother a wonderful spiritual book to read that also softened my mother's heart. And so we talked. She, and I asked her if she was afraid, and she said yes. And then we didn't talk very much more about it. And then it happened. The hospice people told me that dying of lung cancer was not pretty, and it would be very difficult. And they tried to pre-warn me and, you know, get me prepared, and even my mother. And so it was a beautiful day in August when all of a sudden I was at my computer and I heard my mother. She said, "Help me!" And I'm like, now my mom could walk and talk and do everything. She had a walker. She was, you know, she could get around and everything. She's yelling, "Help me!" I yell down, "What's the matter, mother?" I figured she needed to drink water or something, or it was all there. And she said, "Help me! I need your help." And I said, "Okay, I'll be down in a minute." And I finished doing what I was doing. And I went downstairs, and I walked into the bedroom, and there my mother is laying on the floor. She had fallen out of the bed. She had been taking a nap. And I said, "Oh, mother, what happened?" And she tried to talk. She couldn't really tell me. She just said, "Help me." And I said, "Okay." I couldn't lift one part of her. I said, "Well, mother, can you just help me a little bit? Move your arms, push yourself up." So that, I knew I couldn't help her. I called my husband, who was just a few blocks away. He came. He and I both tried to lift her. There was no way we could lift her. He went and got another man, and they were able then together to put her in the bed. And I called hospice, and they came right away. And my mother had had a major stroke, and one entire side of her was completely unable to move, and her ability to speak was almost completely gone. Now, let me tell you, my mother had this great fear that she would spend the rest of her life, after having a stroke, in a nursing home, unable to speak or move. To her, that would be hell. So, as she lay there that night, all I could think of was the fear she must be feeling. It just was horrible. And I remember, I was in bed, and I was sleeping upstairs, and we had an intercom so that we could hear her every move. I couldn't sleep, of course. Yes. And I went downstairs, and I climbed in bed with her, and she kept saying, "Put on the frosting, put on the frosting. There's not enough eggs, there's not enough eggs." And I would say, "Okay, Mom, I'll put the frosting on." And every bit of hurt and anger I ever felt washed away. All I could feel was love and compassion. I was so grateful that I was with her. The whole night of staying, and we went on and on through her, whatever you call them, hallucinations. The next morning, hospice came with the doctor, and they said, "We've got to move your mother to the nursing home." All I could think of was, "Oh, no, don't say that. She'll hear you, and she'll be terrified." And then they explained to me, they said, they made a promise to me. They said, "Okay," because I didn't want her to go to the nursing home. They said, "But you can't. You can't take care of her. You can't lift her. You can't, I mean, just changing her diaper will take, a diaper will take tremendous strength," because she was so flaccid. Anyway, so she said, "Well, let's take her, we're going to take her." And I agreed. I said, "I will let you keep her there for 3-4 days at the longest." And that was only that they said to evaluate her. And so we went. I agreed for us to go, and they called the ambulance that day, and this was the miracle I will never forget. We got into the ambulance. It wasn't really an ambulance, didn't have lights, but it was, you know, transport. And they had my mom on a gurney on this side, and then they had me on, you know, one of those little fold-down things that they have that's about this wide, sitting against the wall without a seatbelt. I thought, "Oh, for sure, you know, I'm going to be with my mom any moment now." And the driver was in the front. I mean, everything rattles in those things. You know. And so my mom is laying there, and I'm able to look right at her. And the driver is in the front seat. I had no awareness of the driver. I only had an awareness of my mother. I was filled with such love. It was as if something so incomprehensible to me, feelings that I had never known. I said to my mom, and remember, she had not been able to speak. She would say those funny things through the night, but she never answered questions directly. And I said, "Mother, do you know I love you?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Mother, do you know that I know you love me?" And she said, "Yes!" So loud that it scared the poor driver. I mean, it was so profound and so beautiful. We went to the nursing home, and she lived for 3 days. During those 3 days, we brought the dogs every day to the nursing home to be with her. All her great-grandchildren and my sons came. We loved her. She couldn't speak very much. We gave her ice, and we were there with her every minute. And then we were going to bring her home the following Monday. They talked me into leaving her 2 more days. And it was Friday morning. I came, and I brought my beautiful, big, strong heart, Labrador. We came in, and the hospice nurse said, "She's going to go today." And I said, "How do you know?" She said, "I know." And this was her dear, the one that was so wonderful, but it's been such a great friend, the sweet Catholic nurse.
went in and I said, Mom, are you afraid?
No.
I said, would you like to hear the angels?
Yes.
I turned the CD on. And you should have seen her face. She radiated with such peace and love. I played it over and over, and I'd ask her, do you want me to play the angels? Yes. Over and over the entire day. And all the children were there with her. And then the hospice nurse came in and said, you know, I think the oxygen, you know, the little, what they call it? The nasal pumps aren't doing her much good. Let's read with them. And I said, Mother, we're going to turn off that oxygen. Okay. She could just say little words. We turned it off, and she was just restful. A little bit harsh breathing, you know. And my family was there, and the children and the dogs. And then finally, I don't know why, I said, could I be alone for a while with my mom? So the nurses came in, and they asked the other woman who was in another bed in the room and her husband to leave, and then my family all left. I knew then why I had learned things I had learned. I went over and I put my arms around her. I will never forget. My arms crossed her chest. I put my head right by her ear, just like Mary did. And I said, Mother, I'm here with you. I'll be with you always. It's time for you to go. And I'm going to go just a little ways. And you don't have to be afraid. I'm going to hold you. Can you feel me? I can feel her body just relax in my arms. I said, now, you can go. We're going to go just a little ways together, and then you can go on. They're there for you. Your mother, your father, everyone who loves you, your Savior. And I held her. I said, now, I want you to breathe nice and slow. And all of a sudden, she went, oh. She breathed so slowly. And she was gone. I felt nothing but love. The nurse came in. I said, she's gone. And she said, okay. And I was alone with her for a few minutes. And then another nurse's aide came in and said, we're going to bathe her. Would you like to stay and help? And I said, yes, please. We started to bathe her. And we were the only, there were two aides and my mom and I alone in there when all of a sudden a little child, my 3-year-old little granddaughter, was sitting there right by my side. She said, Nana, can't I wash Ninja? That's what they call my mother. Can't I help wash Ninja too? And I said, of course. And she took the washcloth and washed my mother's arms and said, I love you, Ninja. She knew that Ninja had died because they had told her to die, and she had come of her own free will to be with her Ninja. Miracles happen. We have to listen. It was the most, can you say, beautiful death? I believe. When I listened to Jeff, I was so touched at the same response he had that every single person I hear has who's had a near-death experience or been through some of the things I've shared with you, which is, death is beautiful. I put a sign above my mother's bed before she died that said, this is a sacred place. My mother is being born into heaven. Please be respectful while you're in this room. What a beautiful gift to be born into heaven. I want to say thank you. And please, if you have any questions, I would be more than glad to answer.
I just have one question, and I know it's just terminology and all, but you spoke earlier, and in the book you read about angels with wings and all, and this winter I took a class from a woman that walks with spirits, and she's a medium, and she said, you know, as you described the tallness of the angels from the child, she said there are very few angels, and they're very tall, but they don't have wings. But she said it's spirits. It's you see the part you remember about people. Maybe it's your mother's hands or the eyes. But they aren't angels with wings that are walking around. So when you said that, I thought...
I got this on. I was going back to my microphone. You know what you're going to have to do? You're going to have to read this book. I was born and raised a Catholic. And so to me, no such thing as an angel without wings. Okay, and then I converted to another faith in which their angels don't have wings. My angels still have wings. So, don't tell anybody because I've been excommunicated, I guess, now from two churches. I don't know. But the reality is that all of my research and near-death experiences is that what it is that brings you the greatest comfort and peace is what you are introduced to. And I believe that God is good. And therefore, if a child is enveloped in wings, because that is comfortable and comforting, how great that is. Wings were actually, when you study art, you learn that one of the reasons why angels were depicted with wings is because that set them apart from the other people in the picture. And same with halos. Except when you read Dr. Lerner's book and what he is now studying, which will be his third book, you learn that he found that they actually are able to see an aura of light, especially as people get closer and closer to the end of their lives. So I am really very strongly, I feel so strongly that light is the greatest gift, and light is love. And when people have a near-death experience, the incredible part that I love, and I think I can hardly wait till I die, because I think Jeff would say this, I remember him talking about this light permeates every cell of your being. And that meeting doesn't have to be this physical being, but those of you, and I know we all have had some kind of spiritual experience or some kind of experience that touches our hearts, and you can feel it. It's not just emotional. It literally seems to be inside of you. And I imagine that when that light permeates you, the people who've had near-death experiences say it's ineffable, meaning there are not words to describe what they have experienced. When they talk about the love that they have for their own family, their own children, they say, as much as I love, it doesn't even begin to touch what that love was like. I had only one experience I had that two actually. I had a bishop who was speaking in a congregation, and he told a story, and then I followed him afterwards because I wanted more of the story. He told a story in which he had a woman come into his ward. This woman moved around a lot, and she was LDS, and she seemed to always be in need, and so every area she went to the minister or the bishop or something to get help. And he was concerned about that, and yet he wanted to help her, and of course he did financially. And he said the first time she came in, he met with her and everything was fine, and he talked about helping her and what he could do. And then he had a meeting with her about 2 weeks later. And he said he had been prayerful about this meeting he was going to have with her because he really wanted to help her. That was all. He did that anyway. He said, whenever I would meet with people. She came into the room, she sat down, and he started to speak with her. And he said something happened to him that had never, ever happened in his life. He said it was as if God's love came right through him, paralyzing him. He was so overwhelming, so powerful, so beautiful, that words could not even express what he was feeling for this young woman. And he said the horrible part was, I wanted to give it to her. I wanted her to feel it. And he said it was so profound. He said, in fact, I felt as if it continued, I wouldn't be able to go on. I don't know that he meant life would stop or what, but it was so profound, so powerful. I thought, wow, that really touched me. We talked about it afterwards, and I said, the only time I've ever heard anyone tell about that kind of love was when I heard people speak of their near-death experiences and what they experienced. So that was really profound to me. Well, was years late, when my mom and I were having a wonderful time together before she had died. She had visited me in our home in Woodland Hills, and we were driving along, and you've got to understand, I have a great respect for all God's creatures. I don't kill flies and things like that. I don't eat things like that either. Ones that go oink or anything. Anyway, so you know how I feel about animals, just by that, by those precious gifts God has given us. My mother and I were just leaving a gas station. As we were pulling out of the gas station, there was a car in front of us, and it was a pickup truck with a yellow lab and a black lab pups in the back. And the back of the car, I mean, what do you call that flap in the back? Was
tailgate,
thank you. I don't know, tailgate, and it was let down. I knew that as the guy was going to take off, those dogs were going to fall out. They were pups, you know, they were maybe 2 months old. And so, sure enough, he took off, and guess what? One of the dogs fell right out. And he slams on his brakes, gets out of the truck, grabs the dog, and swears, and throws it into the back. That's equal to, I mean, my mother is as bad as I am, and so we call her the ninja for a reason, and her response was, let's get out and kill him. And so I followed him, pulled up next to him, rolled down my window, and I said, excuse me, sir. I said, those are just pups in the back of your truck. I said, and you know, they love you, and they depend on you for everything. I said, you might want to close the tailgate. I knew it then, what it was. And he said, oh, yeah, I'll do that. And he got out and he closed the gate. But I knew he hurt those dogs as much as he possibly could. He was an angry man. I started to cry. I mean, I was just so emotional over the whole thing. It touched me deeply. And my mother and I went on, and my mother said, I don't know what we could do. And I said, well, let's try and follow. So we tried, but we couldn't keep up with him. He was gone. So for weeks after that, everywhere I drove, I looked for that car. I figured it was somewhere in Payson or somewhere in Salem, because that's where the gas station was. I was going to find that car, and I was going to steal the dogs. I figured I could take them and find homes for them where they would take it. I never could find the guy. One night, I went to bed, and I just couldn't get those dogs out of my mind and what their lives would be like. And I went to the place in which in my prayers, in which I asked, please forgive me for being religious in this, but in my prayers, I asked the Savior, I said, how could you endure observing such pain? What must it be like to know? I said, could I feel a little of what you feel of your love for these creatures? And like that mission, it was the most powerful feeling I've ever known. It came over me. It was so paralyzing, I could not move. It lasted only seconds, but it was so incredible. Now, the best thing I think is I'll be out of my body when I get it again, and it'll be okay. Because, right, Jim? I'll be all right.
Sure you will.
Anyway, I really feel like we have only touched the iceberg when we love one another. And in terms of what eternal love is and what that light brings us, it doesn't matter your religion or your beliefs. Whoever that power is, I know is good. End of sermon. Thank you.